Chapter 17. Sinners by Nature. The gospel, preachers tell us, is needed because we are sinners. We probably all agree on that, even though the gospel is far more than a solution to personal sin. And many will say, if you ask how come we're sinners, that it's all Adam's fault. They may not use that phrase, but that's what it boils down to. They're referring to the doctrine usually known as original sin. And yes, you've guessed it, that block is being poked. We all know what the Bible presents as the original sin. It was Adam and Eve's eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, recorded in Genesis chapter 3, an act which God had forbidden. We call it the fall. That's not a biblical phrase, so we should be careful not to overuse it. Certainly the sin in Eden never gets a single further mention in the Old Testament. But the doctrine of original sin is something much bigger than the original sin. According to one Bible dictionary, it is a term referring to the universal defect in human nature caused by the fall, entailing the loss of original righteousness and the distortion of the image of God. In simple terms, it holds that you and I are born sinners by virtue of our physical descent from Adam. Sin is our constitutional bent. We are sinners by nature, not just by practice. And thus, it adds, we're under divine condemnation from the moment we're born. I've heard Christians comment to a young mother trying to calm her crying baby of just a few months old. Amazing, isn't it? Sinful right from the start. Here's this infant, selfish and demanding, even at this early age. If ever you wanted evidence for original sin, here it is. That doesn't bless the mother much, but to the evangelical who made the comment, the logic is irrefutable. The baby is obviously too young to understand concepts like right and wrong, so its tantrum is not a deliberately sinful choice, and nobody has taught it to act in this selfish and demanding way. It's not even capable of copying this sinful behaviour from someone else, but it's doing it anyway. Proof positive that the doctrine of original sin is true. Many of us have assumed this doctrine to be a fundamental of the faith, but the block pokers remind us that it isn't. Significantly, the Eastern Orthodox Church has never embraced it. That branch of the church acknowledges that death is a result of Adam's sin, as in Adam all die, but not guilt or a sinful nature. Over the centuries, Christians of other persuasions have also called the doctrine into question. The fact is, until around the 5th century AD, when Augustine shaped it up, it was virtually unknown. Let that sink in. For centuries, there was no original sin block to poke. Do you believe that the Bible teaches we are guilty and rotten from the start? Is it in fact true that sin's infection is passed on genetically through sexual intercourse? Specifically through semen, as the doctrine teaches, making Jesus alone exempt from it. Are you comfortable with the notion that the crying baby is fundamentally sinful and under the judgment of God? The block pokers look for a start at Genesis chapter 3 and point out that there isn't the slightest hint there that Adam's sin would infect his progeny. And they're right. Some see possible hints of it later in the Old Testament, however. For example, as Moses descended Mount Sinai with the law, God declared to him his own love, patience, and faithfulness, but added, "Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sins of the parents to the 3rd and 4th generation. Many would say that this isn't relevant. It simply means that if, for example, a woman gets drunk regularly during pregnancy, her child is likely to be born with fetal alcohol syndrome, whose harmful effects might carry on down the family line for the next generation or two. But if the statement does refer to original sin, does it imply that sin's infection stops after the 3rd or 4th generation? Whatever that verse means, we noted earlier that there is progression in the Old Testament. Later generations of Israelites came to understand God's nature more clearly than their predecessors, often resulting in a complete overthrow of earlier beliefs. This is a case in point. The prophet Ezekiel, centuries after Moses, declared, "The one who sins is the one who will die. The child will not share the guilt of the parent, nor will the parent share the guilt of the child." Ezekiel, led by the Holy Spirit, was reimagining God and moving things forward. Certainly, looked at logically, Moses and Ezekiel can't both be right on this. If their statements are indeed references to the classic doctrine of original sin, the later insight into God's nature overrides the earlier one, and thus the doctrine is undermined. But the progressive revelation idea in relation to original sin suffers a setback, some would say, when we get to the New Testament and Paul. His classic passage on the subject is Romans 5, verses 12 to 19. You should pause and read it before moving on. Clearly, in Paul's thinking here, there is some connection between Adam's sin and negative effects on the rest of us. What that connection is has been disputed. The line you take will be affected by, among other factors, whether you see Adam and Eve as literal individuals, the first members of the human race, or as ciphers representing humanity as a whole. While Paul, for theological reasons, almost certainly took the first view, we saw earlier that DNA evidence disputes that claim. If Paul is right, he does seem to be teaching here that some sort of harmful spiritual infection is passed on biologically. But if instead we consider Adam to be a cipher, we'll read the passage differently. We'll see it as just picturing the way human beings are in general, in an archetypal way. St. Augustine, 5th century AD, took Paul in the first way. What's more, he gave the apostle's statements a sharper focus than Paul himself did. In so doing, he produced the doctrine of original sin that was accepted by the church in later generations. Then, at the Reformation, 1,000 years after Augustine, John Calvin tightened it up even further. So we have three stages in the doctrine's development. The early church taught, and the Eastern church still does, that what we've inherited from Adam is death. The Western church, following Augustine, teaches that we inherit both death and guilt. And Reformed Christianity, following Calvin, holds that we inherit death, guilt, and a sinful nature. It's the latter view that most evangelicals today assume to be what the Bible teaches, and it's this that the block pokers are questioning. Verse 12 of Romans chapter 5 is the key one. In the NIV it reads, "Just as sin entered the world through one man and death through sin, and in this way death came to all people because all sinned." Augustine worked, we know, with a Latin version of Romans. Scholars for years have pointed out that it was a bit iffy on this verse, not accurately reflecting the original Greek. As a result, Augustine took Paul to be saying it was guilt that was spread through Adam's transgression, whereas the verse is saying that it was not guilt, but death. Then there's the little phrase, "all sinned." Supporters of original sin, following Augustine, take it to mean that all sinned in Adam's sin. In other words, because all subsequent generations were, so to speak, in Adam, in the sense that they were his potential offspring, his sin was also theirs. He brought them down with him, even though they were as yet unborn, which seems unfair to us, to say the least. But this, the block pokers insist, is reading into the phrase something that isn't there. On the contrary, Paul says, in verse 14, that Adam is a pattern or type. He is typical of all human beings. If you and I had been put in the same situation in Eden as was Adam, we would likely have sinned in the same way. The phrase "all sinned" means just what it says. Every one of us has sinned. No one denies that, and the fact that we all die proves it. But that's a far cry from Augustine's doctrine of original sin. If we do settle for original sin, we tacitly accept that God condemns you and me for the sin of another person. Are you comfortable with that? The block pokers are certainly not, and neither am I. It's simply unjust. It reminds me of the outrage I felt as a schoolboy years ago when, because one pupil in the class misbehaved, the teacher kept us all in for 15 minutes after the end of school bell. It simply doesn't resonate with a God who is love, and I'm not alone in feeling that way. The Eastern Church shares my misgivings, but Augustinians and Calvinists defend it with vigour. Calvin said that our inherited sinfulness wipes out any residual traces of the image of God in us. We thus suffer from total depravity, the notion that every aspect of our being leans firmly towards the bent side. We are rotten through and through, with no leanings at all except towards sin and evil. Yes, we may at times do a few good things, but none of them are pleasing to God because they come from a polluted heart and thus from ulterior motives. And that polluted heart, in turn, came from Adam. But here's something to ponder. Adam and Eve, as created by God, didn't have a sinful nature, but they sinned anyway. So why can't it just be the same for the rest of us? Along with the block pokers, I believe it is. But does this kind of nitpicking make any difference to anything practical? You may be asking wearily. Yes, it does. It means that when I see people who, as far as I know, don't have any sincere Christian faith, doing good things, I rejoice and praise God for it. Indeed, I see God in it. Traces of what we might call original blessing. But if I hold to original sin, I'll have to write it off as empty good works that can't please God or bring any lasting benefit because they're the product of a sinful nature, like makeup on a corpse, or, as Martin Luther put it, like snow-covered dung. I'm glad to be rid of that attitude. Instead, I can express my appreciation to the person. I could maybe even drop in the comment that in doing the good they did, they expressed the heart of God. That could lead to a fruitful conversation. Virtue is to be celebrated wherever we find it. All human beings do sin, of course, and they all die, but they are certainly not all rotten through and through as Calvin taught that they are. If you reject his position, you'll find yourself warming to people a lot more than you used to. You can share the gospel with them with greater confidence. Rather than hitting them with, "You're a vile sinner, rotten to the core," and then expecting them to want to hear more. And maybe that crying baby isn't demonstrating the reality of original sin. It's just making known, in the only way it can, its elemental need for food or comfort or relief from its colic. As that baby grows to become a toddler, then a teenager, and eventually an adult, we'll see it finding its way in life and society. Like Adam and Eve, it will make mistakes, it will test boundaries, it will sometimes be selfish, and sometimes good and kind. It'll be, in other words, a normal human being, fallible, often confused, sometimes sinful and selfish. It will eventually die, but we can accept all that without needing either Augustine's doctrine of original sin or Calvin's cynical notion of total depravity. What a relief. The Western Church, both Catholic and Protestant, has traditionally viewed sin chiefly in legal terms. We stand guilty before God, the judge. Condemnation and punishment are thus in order. The New Testament certainly uses this metaphor sometimes. The Eastern Church, by contrast, has viewed sin primarily in medical terms, as an infection or sickness. On this view, we all inherit the infection of sin, which in due course will begin to show symptoms. We're all sick. What we need to address our condition is treatment, not punishment. This is the imagery that Jesus himself used. After he called Matthew the tax collector to be his disciple, he attended a meal at Matthew's house, along with his disciples and lots of Matthew's tax collector friends. The Pharisees, who were sticklers for the law, noticed this and asked the disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" Jesus overheard this and replied that it was because these were people who were spiritually sick and knew it, and he was the doctor, able and willing to treat them. And what was his medicine? Here Jesus quotes the prophet Hosea. He said, "It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice, for I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners." Mercy, not judgment, is his medicine, and he is always willing to dispense it freely to all who admit that they are sick and need help. We who love and follow him are called to adopt the same approach in our dealings with today's tax collectors and sinners. We are not to point the finger and condemn them, but extend the understanding and mercy that Jesus himself modelled to people like Matthew. How will that alter the way you deal with people?